KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
It'll be controlled by the United States. Otherwise, I wouldn't make the deal.
President Trump is celebrating a multi-billion dollar deal between U.S. Steel and the Japanese company Nippon Steel.
Just a few months ago, he'd vowed to block the deal. What changed?
Today is Friday, May 30th, and this is All Things Considered. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. On Sunday, Mexicans will elect around 2,600 judges.
Critics say it could make Mexico's Supreme Court irrelevant and erode democracy.
There are also candidates who are very controversial because they have alleged ties to organized crime.
Also this hour, new research on how penguins might be helping to cool the climate.
It has to do with the vast amount of waste that they produce.
It smells a bit like rotten fish mixed with pigeon poop. It doesn't smell good. They don't smell great.
Plus the story of a mini dachshund that ran away.
And the truly mind-boggling effort to bring her home.
After the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. President Donald Trump was near Pittsburgh today celebrating a deal with Japan's Nippon Steel he says will ensure the future of U.S. Steel Corporation and the production of steel in that region. NPR's Don Gagne reports.
Flanked by steel workers and local officials, Trump said Nippon Steel has promised a $14 billion investment with modernization of blast furnaces, a U.S. CEO, and a majority U.S. board of directors for U.S. Steel.
It includes vital protections to ensure that all steel workers will keep their jobs and all facilities in the United States will remain open and thriving.
The president cited a commitment to full capacity for at least a decade. The full agreement has not been released. Local union leaders praised the news, but the International United Steelworkers Organization has been critical, citing, among other things, Nippon Steel's history of violating U.S. trade laws. Don Gagne, NPR News, Pittsburgh.
The militant group Hamas says it's continuing to review a U.S. proposal for a temporary ceasefire in Gaza without an official rejection. However, a reaction to the plan, which the U.S. says has received approval from Israel, has been lukewarm at best. President Trump, meanwhile, continues to say negotiators are close to a deal. Officials speaking on condition of anonymity say the proposal would call for a 60-day pause in fighting, guarantees of serious negotiations leading to a long-term truce, and assurances Israel will not resume hostilities. PBS and a public television station in rural Minnesota have sued President Trump over his executive orders seeking to bar federal funds from going to PBS and NPR. As David Folkenflik reports, NPR and three public radio stations previously filed a similar suit.
The lawsuit contends Trump's order would upend public television and pose an existential threat to Lakeland PBS, which serves central and northern Minnesota. Trump alleges PBS and NPR failed to provide, quote, fair, accurate, unbiased, and nonpartisan news. The two networks deny that. In their lawsuit Friday, the public television outlets argue, quote, our Constitution and laws forbid the president from serving as the arbiter of content. A White House spokesperson says Trump is, quote, exercising his lawful authority to bar the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and local public media stations from sending federal funds to the two networks. CPB is privately incorporated and is ignoring Trump's demand. It's separately suing the president in a fight over control of its board. David Folkenflik, NPR News.
A key inflation gauge showed signs of cooling last month with no signs yet that the Trump administration's tariffs are noticeably pushing up prices. At the same time, Americans saw a jump in their incomes. Commerce Department reporting today consumer prices in April were up just 2.1% compared to the same period a year ago, excluding volatile food and energy costs. Core inflation was up 2.5%. On Wall Street today, the Dow was up 54 points. You're listening to NPR. Virginia is one of the latest states to crack down on the amount of screen time for children. NPR's Windsor Johnston reports it's part of a growing trend as states move to limit how and when young people engage with digital platforms.
Virginia's new law takes effect next year. It aims to limit social media use for minors under 16 to 1 hour per day, unless parents provide verifiable consent to adjust that limit. Sasi Naga is the CEO of Parent Genie, an app that's designed to help parents better monitor their kids' screen time. He says mental health concerns driving these efforts are real.
high levels of screen time are associated with the increased anxiety, disrupted sleep, reduced physical activity, and lower academic engagement.
Other states like Illinois have social media curfew laws that restrict minors from accessing sites between the hours of 10 p.m. and 6 a.m. Windsor Johnston, NPR News.
Music superstar Taylor Swift says she has now regained control over her entire body of work. The singer-songwriter says she's purchased the rights to her first six records from their most recent owner, the private equity firm Shamrock Capital. Originally released through Big Machine Records, Swift over the past few years has also been re-recording and releasing her early albums in an effort to regain control of the rights. Swift did not disclose the price she paid, though music industry publication Billboard, quoting sources, has valued that deal at around $360 million. Crude oil futures prices continue to bounce around a bit today, oil down 15 cents a barrel to $60.79 a barrel. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Lilly Endowment, a private foundation supporting NPR's coverage of religion and spirituality, and Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. President Trump traveled to Pennsylvania today to celebrate a multi-billion dollar deal, a deal between the iconic American company U.S. Steel and Japanese rival Nippon Steel.
We're here today to celebrate a blockbuster agreement that will ensure this storied American company stays an American company. You're going to stay an American company. You know that, right?
Trump says U.S. Steel will remain under domestic control, but there are still all kinds of questions about this agreement, including whether or not it is final. NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez is here to break down what Trump is promising. Hey, Franco.
Hey, Mary Louise.
Hey, so you've been watching his speech outside Pittsburgh tonight. What'd you see?
Yeah, I mean, it felt very much like a campaign stop, but he's surrounded by steelworkers. I mean, he walked onto the stage to his campaign music, and he delivered a very political speech. I mean, he attacked Biden, he touted how much he loves tariffs, and it was actually when he was talking about his tariff agenda when he stopped to say that he had another big announcement to deliver. And he told the crowd that he's doubling tariffs on foreign steel imports.
We're going to bring it from 25% to 50%, the tariffs on steel into the United States of America, which will even further secure the steel industry in the United States.
He promised no U.S. steel layoffs as a result of the deal, and that all steel workers will receive a $5,000 bonus. And as you said, we still don't know, though, if this deal is a final deal or when it will go into effect.
But back up a second, Franco, because President Trump had opposed this deal. He said he would block it. President Biden before him had said the same thing. What changed?
Yeah, both of them said they were against it during the campaign. You know, Biden said it was because of grounds on national security. Trump said he would do the same on the same grounds. But Trump clearly changed his tune, announcing last week that a $14 billion deal that he said will keep U.S. steel in the U.S. as well as in Pittsburgh.
Yeah, and we said there's still a lot of questions. Do we know how different this deal looks than what was proposed before?
Yeah, I mean, that part is really hard to say. I mean, the details are still quite murky, and there are real questions about if it is different. I mean, Trump, though, insisted that the company would remain under U.S. control. But when you talk to industry analysts about these things, those who are following all the different moves, I mean, they say this may not be that different than what was originally proposed. You know, the selling of U.S. steel. But they say Trump is calling it a partnership to avoid sounding like he switched his position. And I'll just add that Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro, a Democrat who does support the deal, he also calls it an acquisition of U.S. steel by Nippon.
an acquisition, a deliberate word choice there, because it suggests that this is an American company that would be taken over?
Yeah, I mean, and that's really controversial, you know, because it is an iconic U.S. company. For it to be taken over by a foreign entity would be a big deal. You know, the reality is that U.S. Steel, though, has struggled financially, and that the company's own leaders have argued that it needs to be sold in order to protect jobs. And look, the union that represents many of these workers, they have also raised a lot of concerns about this deal. Just last week, the U.S. steel workers claimed that these were all just flashy promises about proposed investments, but that it was clear to them that Nippon is really just focused on undercutting the steel industry from the inside.
White House correspondent Franco Ordonez, thanks.
Thank you, Mary Louise.
The world has never seen an election quite like the one that Mexico will hold on Sunday. Mexicans will elect around 2,600 judges, from local magistrates all the way to members of the Supreme Court. It's the first step in a constitutional overhaul that will eventually see voters replacing the entire existing judiciary with people who are directly elected. We called David Mora, a senior analyst at International Crisis Group, to learn more about this giant experiment. Welcome to the program.
Hello, Juana. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being here. Okay, David, this is happening on Sunday. Help us understand how all of this is supposed to work.
The process has been really controversial so far. You know who gets to be on the ballots, what names we're going to be able to pick from. And I think part of that is why the turnout is expected to be low. It's also going to be a really complex voting. There's thousands and thousands of candidates. Campaigning has been very limited, so there's little information, and people, when they go to the polls, those who actually show up at the polls, they're going to have trouble, you know, waving through all the ballots that they have to pick their candidates from.
I have to say, just thinking about this from the perspective of voters, it sounds quite complicated. Can you help us understand why Mexico made the decision to change the way the judiciary is selected?
Right. This election, as you mentioned, is a product of this major judicial overhaul that was pushed by the ruling party, Morena, former President Andrés Manuel López Obrador, and his successor, now President Claudia Sheinbaum. They are convinced that electing judges is going to make them, more accountable to their constituents, and therefore it's going to decrease corruption within the court system, and then it's going to end Mexico's severe problem of impunity. I think that diagnosis is not entirely wrong. The judiciary did have a problem of corruption, especially nepotism. Critics, though, they say that you need to understand the constant clashing that former President López Obrador had with the courts throughout his 6 years in office. You know, he won by a landslide, and he controlled both the Senate and the House. So the only effective check and balance on his executive power was the court system.
Right.
And in multiple times, the courts stopped his agenda and his reforms. And it became common for him to attack judges and even Supreme Court justices, accusing them of corruption and wrongdoing.
So obviously, Mexico's Congress agreed with this overhaul. But now that it's actually happening, I do wonder, do the Mexican people that they represent like this? And do they think it will solve the issues with criminals acting with impunity?
So actually, I mean, the polls are available. They show a pretty split opinion on the election, right? Those who are in favor, they do think that this move is going to, you know, bring an end to the major problem of impunity, because it's going to, electing the judges, it's going to just create more independent courts. Critics of the election, they see also like the possibility of political capture of the entire court system. We have candidates that have clear ties to, you know, politicians and who might be answering to political bosses. Because of this, that critics say that, you know what, we're not making a more independent and solid judiciary. We actually are kind of like weakening the judiciary that we used to have.
I'd love to know a bit more about who's running. Are there many judges that are campaigning for the seats they currently have, or are we seeing a lot of newcomers who are sort of streaming in?
Right. All the sitting judges were given the opportunity to run for the place that they currently occupy, but hundreds of them declined, protesting the reform and the election. The type of people that we see running, I mean, according to media reports, not only candidates with clear political ties, but there are also candidates who are very controversial because they have ties to, alleged ties to organized crime. So, for instance, we have a person that is running who at some point represented former kingpin, now in prison in the United States, El Chapo Guzman. We also have candidates with little to no experience. We have people in their early 20s who just got out of college. We also have candidates who are in the retirement age. There's a candidate, for instance, who's 88 years old, and he's trying to occupy a position.
So, David, tell us, what will you be watching out for after Sunday's election?
Okay, so first of all, the results are not going to be immediately available, so we're going to have to wait for 2 weeks to see who was elected. And after that, I think it is going to take months and maybe years to really see the impacts that this election is going to have, both like positive and negative impacts. Thinking forward to the election in 2027, that is the next round, and we're going to choose another round of judges in 2 years. And I think it's going to be crucial that we amend all these problems that were documented throughout the process, because that is going to make a stronger election.
David Mora, senior analyst at the International Crisis Group. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Juana.
He started playing music at an early age, and as a teenager, he topped the charts with a hit that became a signature anthem for sports fans in Ohio, his home state. Rick Derringer died Monday at age 77. For member station WKSU in Cleveland, Kabir Bhatia has a look back at his career.
The song Hang On Sloopy by the McCoys was a number one hit in 1965. The lead singer was 17-year-old Rick Derringer, who was born and raised in Ohio. The song, with its sing-along chorus, soon became a mainstay of Ohio State University football games and sporting events throughout the Buckeye State. 20 years later, Hang On Sloopy was declared the official rock song of the state of Ohio. By then, Derringer had worked as a sideman for everyone from Barbra Streisand to Steely Dan to Kiss, even scoring his own hits, like this 1973 song that became a classic rock staple. As a producer, Derringer also helmed Weird Al Yankovic's string of 80s hits and won a Grammy for producing Eat It, a parody of Michael Jackson's Beat It. Derringer even played the guitar solo, replicating the original by Eddie Van Halen. A year later, he produced the World Wrestling Federation's The Wrestling Album and wrote Hulk Hogan's theme song, Real American. Derringer toured with Ringo Starr in the 2010s. Later in the decade, he spoke of his renewed interest in the Bible and his support for President Donald Trump. No cause of death has been released, but he reportedly had various medical conditions in recent years, which NPR has not confirmed. For NPR News, I'm Kabir Bhatia in Cleveland.
You're listening to All Things Considered.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from BritBox, committed to shaking up people's watch list with British TV, including new original series like Ludwig, starring Peep Show's David Mitchell. Streaming now at BritBox.com/NPR. From Raymond James, a firm focused on transforming lives, businesses, and communities through tailored wealth management, banking, and capital market solutions. Disclosures at RaymondJames.com. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. When President Trump established the Make America Healthy Again Commission back in February, he gave it marching orders. Trump said that within 100 days, he wanted to see a Make Our Children Healthy Again assessment. Well, this month, a team headed up by Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. delivered, releasing a 73-page report that opens by saying the health of American children is in crisis. The pages that follow catalog many reasons why, and the authors cite more than 500 references to back up their claims. Only problem is, some of the scientific papers that the report cites do not exist. Margaret Manto and Emily Kennard with the nonprofit news site Notice, that's short for News of the United States, they broke the story, and Margaret Manto is here now. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
How did you first realize there was something off about these journal citations?
I got a tip Saturday morning that there was maybe something going on with the citations in the report, and I started looking through them right away, you know, just kind of haphazardly on my computer. Mm-hmm. But after I looked at just a couple, I realized like, oh, I'm going to have to look at every single one of these because it was pretty obvious pretty quickly that there were at least some issues.
Yeah. I mean, among the issues, you spoke with researchers whose names were attached to some of the studies being cited. Tell me what Catherine Keyes told you.
So epidemiologist Catherine Keyes was listed in the report as the first author of a study on anxiety in adolescents during the pandemic. But when we reached out to her, she had never heard of this paper because she didn't write it. So she told us that she had never done research on that topic and that she'd never worked with the other authors listed on the paper, and that it didn't appear to be a real paper.
Didn't appear to be a real paper. I mean, is it clear who did write it? Is it clear that anyone wrote the paper?
So when we tried to find the paper listed online, we weren't able to find it anywhere. So that plus what Keyes said made us pretty confident that it just wasn't a real paper.
Have you been able to nail down how these errors happened, how they all got in there?
We don't know at this point. I know that there has been some really great follow-up reporting in the Washington Post looking at markers for AI. And so they found that there were some links that included a signifier that the link was generated using AI. And that's something that a lot of people have hypothesized could be going on here. But that's one of the possibilities that we're looking into still.
What does Health and Human Services say about all this?
They were very confident still in the substance of the report. They didn't answer any direct questions about what kinds of tools were maybe used to generate it, if they used any AI tools. But yeah, they really focused on the body of the report and made it pretty clear that they didn't feel like the kinds of formatting issues, as they called these missing citations, didn't change the substance of the report, in their opinion.
So what's your takeaway from this? What are the implications of problems like this in a Make Our Children Healthy Again assessment?
I think most scientists, all scientists, will agree that citations are not the most enjoyable part of research, but they are really critical when it comes to establishing your scientific credibility. And, you know, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and his MAHA movement are really fighting an uphill battle right now, trying to establish themselves as the scientific leadership for the country. And a report like this with these kinds of issues, I think, will not help them in that regard.
Margaret Manto is a reporter with Notice. Her piece is titled, "The Maha Report Cites Studies That Don't Exist." Margaret, thank you.
Thank you.
And now for a story about a homecoming for a tiny dog named Valerie. She's a mini dachshund who ran away during a family camping trip on a remote Australian island. And she survived on her own for 529 days. NPR's Kat Lonsdorf has the story.
Valerie, roughly 10 pounds with short little legs and a long black body, doesn't quite look like a dog who recently survived more than 17 months in the Australian wilderness. She's sitting on the couch, bundled in a blanket, on the laps of her owners, Georgia Gardner and Josh Fishlock, as they talk over Zoom.
She is the queen of the house. It is her house, and we live in it.
But for well over a year, Valerie was missing from that house after getting spooked on a camping trip in a remote area of Kangaroo Island back in 2023.
We searched and searched.
Hiking through the hills for 5 days, nonstop.
And eventually, the couple had to return home to mainland Australia.
The decision to leave the island was probably the hardest decision I think I've ever made in my life, because we went over there as three and we were going back as two.
They tried to hold out hope that someone would find her, but weeks turned into months and still there was no word about Valerie. Until this February, more than a year after she first disappeared, when a farmer on the island snapped a photo of a tiny black dog running through a field. That photo made it to Lisa Karen.
Said, "Oh, that must be the little Valerie that went missing a year ago."
Lisa and her husband Jared run Kangala Wildlife Rescue, a local organization generally focused more on working with wildlife than pets. They'd originally been in contact with Valerie's parents when she went missing.
So it sort of started from there.
Lisa says that's when they got to work, trying to rescue Valerie during their off hours. It was no small feat. First, they put out about a dozen small basic traps, but caught pretty much everything except Valerie. Possums, feral cats, wallabies.
Even some kangaroos put their little big heads in there.
So along with a team of other volunteers, they began experimenting, often working long nights with little to no sleep, documenting along the way.
We're out in the middle of nowhere. It's 3:30 in the morning. It's freezing cold. It's like 5 degrees.
Eventually, they rigged up a big pen with a roof, several wildlife cameras, and a remote-controlled door.
We've set up the cage with all the comforts of home for little Valerie. We've got her toys and teddies and blankets.
Setting it in the spot where Valerie had last been seen. And finally, after nearly 2 months, everything lined up. Valerie entered the pen, relaxed a little bit, and they hit the remote to drop the door. No one quite knows exactly how Valerie survived. Lisa speculates she was drinking water from nearby farms, burrowing for shelter and scavenging for food. After her capture, Valerie went to the vet and got a clean bill of health. She'd even gained some weight.
She's got the physique of like a little bodybuilder.
Valerie has been back home for about 2 weeks. Her owners say she settled right back in, playing with her toys, cuddling in bed, going on walks. But Gardner says she's not exactly the same.
She's kind of come back a little bit more independent.
Gardner and Fishlock say they've been flooded with messages, with many people saying Valerie's story gave them hope.
You know, if a tiny little 4-kilo sausage dog can survive on Kangaroo Island in the Australian bush, then, you know, you two can survive whatever it is you're going through.
But clearly, Valerie is also content bundled in a blanket, sitting on a couch, too. Kat Lonsdorf, NPR News.
And if you want to see photos of little Valerie, head to npr.org.
This is NPR News.
The new Wes Anderson film is a comedy caper with an extravagant cast. Its star, Benicio del Toro, says the key to nailing that signature deadpan tone is to just play it straight.
There were a lot of laughs on the set, but maybe not in front of the camera.
The Phoenician Scheme and all the latest news Saturday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
Thank you.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. A massive spending bill intended to enact President Trump's domestic policy agenda is making its way through Congress.
It's now heading to the Senate, where one big critic is Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson.
The big, beautiful bill isn't what it's advertised to be.
That's ahead after the news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. Today is billionaire Elon Musk's last day as a special government employee, although President Trump says his advisor and Doge architect isn't really leaving, as both men met with a select group of reporters in the Oval Office today. NPR's Stephen Fowler has more.
This marks the end of a 130-day tenure that also saw Musk face rising unfavorability numbers, financial stress on his business empire, and talk of a rift between the world's richest man and its most powerful political leader. Trump, appearing to largely read notes from a binder, offered praise for Musk's work as, quote, one of the greatest business leaders and innovators the world has ever produced.
He stepped forward to put his very great talents into the service of our nation, and we appreciate it.
Musk and Trump both say the money Doge will save the government will continue to grow, though many of those claims have been inaccurate and overstated so far. Stephen Fowler, NPR News.
The president says China has violated an agreement on trade talks. It's a sharp break from recent optimism when Trump lowered his 145% tariffs on Chinese goods to 30% as both countries continue negotiating. The president's use of tariffs have roiled financial markets and created a sense of uncertainty for U.S. businesses. This week, the administration also announced that it would start revoking visas for Chinese students studying in the U.S. White House Chief of Staff Stephen Miller speaking to reporters about that.
We are going to stop the practice of allowing China to conduct espionage through the student visa program, one of the cornerstones of China's industrial strategy.
A federal court ruled this week that Trump overstepped his authority with his sweeping tariffs, but said they can remain in place while the White House appeals that ruling. You're listening to NPR News. Senators Lindsey Graham, a Republican, and Richard Blumenthal, a Democrat, are visiting the Ukrainian capital. NPR's Hannah Polomarenko tells us that Ukraine's president and the bipartisan delegation discussed imposing new sanctions on Russia.
Thank you for coming. Thank you for having us.
President Zelensky thanked the U.S. lawmakers for co-sponsoring a bill that would impose 500% tariffs on goods from countries that purchase Russian oil products. It has already received the support of more than 80 U.S. senators. Senator Lindsey Graham said in Kyiv these sanctions could break Russia's military machine.
Russia is playing a game at the expense of the world, not just the United States. We're going to change that game for Russia. The game that Putin's been playing is about to change.
The senators emphasized that if Putin does not agree to serious peace talks to end the war in Ukraine, these sanctions could come into effect. Hanna Polomarenko, NPR News, Kyiv.
Millions of people are bracing for severe weather tonight as a powerful storm system makes its way up the East Coast. National Weather Service says nearly 45 million people are on alert in the south and east, with high winds and severe tornado activity likely. One person was killed and several others injured this morning in southeast Louisville, Kentucky, after a tornado with 115-mile-an-hour winds blew through the area. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station And from Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. From Amazon Business, offering business buying services from office supplies to IT essentials and maintenance tools to help bring visions to life. Learn more at AmazonBusiness.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at MacFound.org.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. The massive Republican spending bill working its way through Congress would cement a lot of President Trump's domestic priorities. It has made its way through the House so far, but next week it heads to the Senate, where a small group of Republicans has expressed big concerns over the size of spending. Chief among those critics is Wisconsin's Ron Johnson, who says he has enough allies to force changes to the bill. Here to tell us more is Wisconsin Public Radio's Anya Van Wagtendonk. Hi there.
Hi there.
So, Anya, Ron Johnson seems to be leading this pushback to the president's budget bill in the Senate. So tell us what it's his issue.
Yeah, put really simply, he is opposed to the cost of this thing. Johnson has built much of his political career around being a fiscal hawk, and then along comes this bill that congressional budget forecasters with the Joint Committee on Taxation now say could cost nearly $4 trillion over the next decade. And so for Ron Johnson, that all comes down to reducing, in his words, spending, spending, spending. Now, he does support some spending that's in there for the military and immigration enforcement, but he says there needs to be huge cuts to balance that out. Right now, cuts mainly come from things like changes to Medicaid and food assistance. And Johnson says that's not enough to achieve what he wants, which is a return to pre-pandemic spending levels.
Right. And this is sort of interesting because President Trump typically enjoys near unanimous support from Republicans in Congress. So how surprising is it then to see Senator Johnson pushing back?
Yeah, Johnson has been publicly calling for massive reductions in federal spending as far back as his first campaign for the Senate in 2010, sort of part of what sprung him into politics. But he is a significant Trump ally, and so it is a little surprising to hear him come out so forcefully against something that's meant to be a signature Trump piece of policy. So he's kind of threading that needle by being more critical of his colleagues in Congress, basically saying, I support Trump's overall agenda, but this isn't the way to get there. Here he is speaking to a local crowd at the state Republican Party convention in Rothschild, Wisconsin, earlier this month.
I want President Trump to succeed. Again, I can't tell you how pleased I am with how boldly and decisively and swiftly he is acting to honor those promises. But the big, beautiful bill isn't what it's advertised to be.
Senator Johnson, they're using the nickname for this bill. So tell us, Anya, who else is with him? And does he have enough support to actually force the changes that he wants?
He says he does, and there are a few other senators who have been outspoken on this. One of them is Rand Paul of Kentucky, another fiscal hawk. He's kind of less worked up about the overall spending. He says anemic cuts are better than no cuts at all, but he draws the line at the way the bill would raise the debt ceiling. Another opponent has been Missouri's Josh Hawley. He has big issues with the cuts to Medicaid that are in the bill, which interestingly is actually much more in line with Democrats' criticisms.
Got it. So tell us, what happens if they vote against this?
Well, margins in the Senate are really slim. Republicans have only 3 votes to spare, and that's assuming no Democrats are on board. Johnson has said he will not vote for the bill in its current form. Rand Paul says he will not vote to increase the debt ceiling. And House Speaker Mike Johnson says he is taking this opposition seriously. He's talked about how delicate it is to get something this massive through Congress. He's compared it to trying to walk across the Grand Canyon on dental floss. And it's important to note here that any changes the Senate ends up making to the bill will have to go back to the House for approval. So a little bit of difference here is a big deal, could really mess things up for Speaker Mike Johnson, though it offers quite a bit of power to Senator Ron Johnson.
That was Wisconsin Public Radio's Anya Van Wagtendonk. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
What if anybody could make a website or a smartphone app just by telling their computer, do it, without needing to know anything about programming? Well, that is quickly becoming a reality thanks to artificial intelligence, and this could have big implications for what it means to be a programmer. NPR's John Ruich explains.
Chloe Samaha's startup Bond offers software that helps company leaders stay on top of projects and manage the fire hose of information they face every day. She explains from a San Francisco coffee shop.
It's an AI chief of staff for CEOs and busy execs.
Samaha wasn't trained to write code. She and her business partner built the first version of the product and the website through a process called vibe coding. It's a new term coined earlier this spring, and it means using AI chatbots like ChatGPT as well as other new AI tools to code software. The beauty is that you don't need to know anything about coding software. Samaha says she and her business partner split the work and it was pretty painless.
He was on his way back from a ski trip and built the entire back end in everything in 6 hours. And I built the front end in like an hour and a half. And we just had a functional product.
Artificial intelligence is shaking up the world of tech, and software development is at the bleeding edge. Samaha, who's 21 and just graduated from college, says Bond recently got a $500,000 investment from the venture capital firm Y Combinator. Tom Blomfield is a group partner there. He knows how to code. But to test AI's fast-evolving ability to create software, he vibe-coded, mostly with voice commands, a website called Recipe Ninja. It can make recipes and interact with cooks.
It's probably like 30,000 lines of code now. That would have taken me, maybe a year to build. And I did it. It wasn't overnight, but I probably spent 100 hours on that.
I gave Recipe Ninja's voice assistant a spin, asking it to come up with a recipe using my Memorial Day barbecue leftovers.
Here's an idea for a delicious dish. Cheeseburger and bratwurst breakfast skillet. Ingredients.
Okay, AI's culinary tastes may be a work in progress, but Blomfield says he expects it to radically change the software industry.
Instead of having coding assistants, we're going to have actual AI coders, and then an AI project manager, an AI designer, and a kind of, over time, an AI manager of all of this, and we're going to have swarms of these things.
If it's all done by AI, I asked him, where do people fit in?
Really, that is the question we're all grappling with.
In 2021, Blomfield told a podcast that would-be startup founders should learn to code first and foremost. Today, he's not so sure he'd give that same advice.
Coders feel like they are tending kind of organic gardens by hand, you know? They're pruning little bonsai trees or something. And it's very valuable, the work they do. But we are producing these superhuman agents that are going to be as good as the best coders in the world, like very, very soon.
For many designers of websites and apps, it's a boon. Vibe coding tools allow them to try lots of things quickly rather than having to hand their ideas off to software engineers to create prototypes one by one.
For every idea, there are 10 ideas that are not explored today because there simply isn't the time.
Yuki Yamashita is chief product officer at Figma, a leading design software firm. Earlier this month, it rolled out an AI-enabled product that effectively lets designers vibe code.
So we think that more ideas will be explored and more ideas will be validated much, much faster.
That may translate into demand for more designers. Adam Resnick, a research manager with the tech consultancy IDC, says software developers may also have a little runway ahead of them, even if things are progressing quickly.
The vast majority of developers are using AI tools in some way. What we also see is that a reasonably high percentage of the code output from those tools needs further curation by people, by experienced people.
And that's a job that AI can't do, at least not yet. John Ruwich, NPR News, San Francisco.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. It's getting harder and more expensive to find homeowners insurance in the U.S. In Texas, federal data shows insurers are often deciding not to renew policies, and insurance companies sometimes make those decisions by relying on computers, analyzing information about homes that no inspector visited. Audrey McGlinchey from member station KUT reports.
Tracy Gartenman got an email from her insurance company in January. Travelers Insurance told her she had 2 months to trim the trees near her house or risk losing coverage.
I thought it was a scam.
Two grainy photos taken from above Gartenman's home in Austin were attached to the email. Gartenman says she had no idea her insurance company had sky-high eyes on her house.
I've never spent a whole lot of time thinking about my homeowner's insurance, but I guess it wouldn't have crossed my mind that that would have been a mechanism or a technique that a corporation could use.
Interviews with homeowners and documents obtained through records requests, including a dozen state investigations, confirm insurers in Texas commonly use aerial images and artificial intelligence to decide if they will keep insuring homes. It's long been industry standard to use satellite or airplane photos to assess storm damage, but using these images to determine policy renewals is relatively new. And homeowners and consumer advocates worry the practice leads to inaccuracies. Ware Wendell is the head of Texas Watch, a consumer advocacy group.
We're really losing the human touch when it comes to the purchasing and servicing and adjusting of insurance policies. And I think that that's a bad thing for policyholders.
Since 2023, at least a dozen homeowners have asked the Texas Department of Insurance to investigate the use of aerial photos by insurance companies. In one case, a homeowner lost coverage after an insurance company looked at the wrong image. That story bugs Elena Callahan. Callahan lives outside Houston. In March, her insurer said if she wanted to keep her coverage, she needed a new roof. But her roof was only 5 years old and in good condition. Callahan asked to see the aerial photos they had used.
How did they inspect my house? Where's the images? What images are they using?
In filings with the state, five insurers operating in Texas say they use third-party aerial photos. Some of these same companies say they use AI to analyze these images, which Callahan says she never got to see.
I had no recourse as a homeowner, none whatsoever.
We sent a list of questions to five home insurance companies operating in Texas, including Travelers Insurance. We asked how they use aerial photos, how accurate they are, and what rights homeowners have to contest any conclusions. Two companies responded with general statements in which they confirmed using aerial photos, but said little else. On any given day, you can drive around Central Texas and see workers replacing roofs. It makes sense that insurers want eyes on this part of a home. Damaged roofs are often their biggest liability. Industry experts say using aerial photos and AI is more efficient and cheaper than sending out human inspectors.
Which is very invasive and also could be potentially hazardous because that inspector typically have to climb on your roof to assess the roof.
Mark Friedlander works for the Insurance Information Institute, an industry organization. The use of aerial images and AI is not just happening in Texas. According to news reports, insurers in California, Pennsylvania, and Florida are using aerial photos to decide whether to drop customers. It's a practice Friedlander says will only become more common.
Companies that still haven't adopted this technology, they will eventually.
So next time you look up, smile. It might be your insurance company. For NPR News, I'm Audrey McGlinchey in Austin.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. It's All Things Considered. From NPR News, I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. The current leaders of the FBI have spent years entertaining conspiracy theories and building suspicions about the agency they now run. Deputy Director Dan Bongino, in particular, openly disputed official reports that sex trafficker Jeffrey Epstein died by suicide. Here he is on his former show 2 years ago.
Listen, that Jeffrey Epstein story is a big deal. Please do not let that story go. Keep your eye on this.
But last week, Bongino's tune changed.
I've seen the whole file. He killed himself.
That's from an interview he and FBI Director Kash Patel did with Fox Business. Bongino's reversal on Epstein stunned many observers. But as NPR's Lisa Hagen reports, what happened next tells us more about how conspiracy-minded communities are making sense of Trump's second term.
There's been skepticism about Epstein's 2019 suicide across the political spectrum. But on the right, Epstein's story has been used to advance narratives about what often gets called the deep state. That's the conspiracist idea that there are entrenched government officials working to undermine President Trump. So there was some snickering and disbelief after Bongino insisted that Epstein really did kill himself, including from former Fox News host Tucker Carlson.
I love Bongino. He's a friend of mine. But you weren't convinced by that?
No.
Carlson's guest was podcaster Sean Ryan. As for Patel, before Trump picked him to run the FBI, he said it should be easy for the agency to release a list of Epstein's associates. Here he is with podcaster Benny Johnson in 2023.
Put on your big boy pants and let us know who the pedophiles are.
But after their recent interview, rather than collectively turning on Patel and Bongino, many in the conspiracist or pro-Trump media actually just began to speculate about what was really going on. Here are podcasters Patrick Bet-David and Ashley Epp.
There's a part of me that believes Trump is behind all of this because Trump wants to use this as a leverage of negotiating against the enemy.
And there was a pregnant pause before he said the victims and the victim identity. I think they're protecting an ongoing investigation.
Mike Rothschild is a journalist and author who focuses on conspiracy theories. And he says in moments like this, after the initial burst of anger,
then the really sort of pretzel-like defenses start of having to justify why there's a bigger reason why these guys said something.
Rothschild says this mental process is actually where QAnon conspiracy theories came from during Trump's first term. He says Q followers believed a heroic Trump was going to lead a storm of arrests and executions of high-profile figures for their involvement in supposed satanic pedophile cabals.
QAnon emerged as a way to explain, well, it's happening, it's just happening in secret. And we have to do it in a way that the normies can't figure out and push back against.
After Bongino and Patel spoke to Fox, there were QAnon promoting show hosts who were clearly frustrated. But even there, you could see this other tendency playing out. Here's one host who goes by the pseudonym Shipwreck.
I want better answers than we've been getting. I want what we were promised. And if you can't give us what we were promised, then why did you promise it to us in the first place?
She's enraged, but in the comments, her audience is already saying it makes sense to them that the FBI officials had to say that because actually Epstein is still alive or the big arrests are still coming. Another person posts, maybe it's just a test of faith. Here's Rothschild.
There's always something that turns a disconfirmation into a confirmation.
Epstein's death, QAnon, and the deep state are, of course, not the only conspiracy theories that have helped elevate Trump and his officials. Health and Human Services Secretary Robert Kennedy Jr. built a following promoting the disproven theory that measles vaccines cause autism. Rothschild says that when RFK Jr. endorsed the MMR vaccine last month,
a lot of the big anti-vax figures were openly tweeting, like, how could you say this? You know, we voted for Trump to get big pharma out of politics. And like days later, he was back saying, well, the vaccine's not really effective. I don't really recommend it.
He says that officials who've helped boost conspiracy theories are likely to continue to face uncomfortable moments as they try to govern. Some may even fall out of favor with their former followers, but the beliefs themselves aren't going anywhere. As for releasing more on Epstein's death, Bongino was back on Fox Thursday promising, quote, disclosure on this coming shortly. Lisa Hagen, NPR News.
A lot lot of things affect our climate, including things like penguin poop. Lauren Sommer from NPR's Climate Desk reports on a new study about how penguins could be helping to cool the planet.
At the tip of the Antarctic Peninsula, there's a colony of 60,000 Adelie penguins.
When you approach it, you're not really ready to see the scale of the actual number of birds, but you can smell it from a long way away.
That's Matthew Boyer, an atmospheric scientist at the University of Helsinki, who was there studying them. It smells because a lot of penguins means a lot of poop.
It smells a bit like rotten fish mixed with pigeon poop. It doesn't smell good. They don't smell great.
One day, when the wind shifted their way, Boyer and his colleagues noticed a thick fog was forming. Over weeks, they were able to measure how all that penguin waste seemed to be causing that, which could be happening all over Antarctica. They published the findings in the journal Communications, Earth and Environment. Here's how it works. Penguin waste gives off ammonia gas, which goes into the air and runs into other gases.
When they hit each other and they interact, they stick, and these clusters of molecules end up growing.
Those particles become the seeds for clouds because they attract water vapor. Clouds can't actually form without particles. And clouds affect how warm our climate is.
Clouds are important for climate because they're bright and they're white and they're in the sky.
They act like giant reflectors, blocking sunlight that would heat up the Earth. That means in the Antarctic, clouds that penguins help form could be cooling the atmosphere. Boyer says more research needs to be done because in some cases, clouds can also act like a blanket, trapping heat. It's important in the bigger picture of how the climate is changing.
The Antarctic environment and changes to the Antarctic environment has a global impact.
The poles are warming faster than the rest of the planet, and their melting glaciers are causing sea levels to rise, which could affect millions of people. So penguin waste could actually matter to coastal communities around the world.
It's quite interesting how such a small thing that you would never necessarily think about can have an impact on something else that's much bigger than itself.
Other research has shown how seabirds in the Arctic could also be cooling the atmosphere. Jeff Pierce is a professor of atmospheric science at Colorado State University who worked on that study. He says the main reason seabirds could have an impact there is there isn't a lot of other source material for clouds, like dust or pollution.
There aren't a lot of existing particles in the Arctic. It's pretty clean. And small things, small details in these regions, such as the ammonia that comes off poop, can make a difference in the number of particles.
Pierce says there's a lot more to understand about this process. The challenge is that in a warming climate, it's changing as fast as they can study it. Lauren Sommer, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Workday. Workday is an AI platform for forward thinkers dedicated to transforming the way business leaders manage people and money today so they can transform tomorrow. Workday, moving business forever forward. From Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, which monitors safe driving habits to determine a personalized rate, at progressive.com, not available in California or from all agents. From Fisher Investments, Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk.